gonna try to time myself. Good evening, my name is Rachel and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 8/28/2003 and I have a sponsor and I have a home group. It's the Miami Young People's Group. We meet at South Miami Lutheran on the corner of 72nd and 72nd. Southwest, oh my God. So I don't know why, I mean I'm so blessed that I get to speak a lot, but whenever I speak in front of a lot of young people, I get very nervous, and I think it's because it's so important to me, because young people saved my life, and it's nice to really care about something. Actually, you know, I should turn that into a positive, because I never cared about anything. I was born and raised in Miami, Florida. As soon as I came out, as soon as my mom had me, she had tried for a really long time to have a baby, and she actually had like 11 miscarriages, and then she got pregnant with me, and I'm a miracle, and yay, and I was premature, and so I was just sucking the life out of my parents from the time I was born, and I'm trying not to be so morbid, I'm sorry, but I feel like super anxious right now, and I have this sweating disorder called hyperhidrosis in my hands and feet, and my hands are like soaking wet right now. I'm going to try to put it into my hair so that you can't see it as much, but okay, but that's why I drank, obviously. So, you know, just from the gate, I feel like I was born with this deal, alcoholism. Always felt maladjusted, like I didn't fit in. I felt like there had been this day at school where I had missed, and they had passed out these instructions that said, like, here's the memo on how you're supposed to hold your hands when you're speaking, how you're supposed to interact with other children, the way that you're supposed to play on the playground. Like, these were things that just baffled me, and I would look at other kids, and they seemed like they were just doing it effortlessly. You know, and the way that they spoke, it didn't seem like they were so painfully self-aware of every word that was coming out of their mouth, and that they didn't have this committee in their head that was like, God, that sounded so stupid. You know, you are so stupid, and you're not as pretty as that girl. And look at her pink Barbie backpack. Like, you don't have something like that. And so I just, you know, would sit there staring at people, and I think I was really socially awkward. I'm not incredibly improved in that area, but I am able to have conversations with people today. And actually, I've had a couple jobs, and, you know, so things have gotten better for me. But, I started getting sexually abused when I was 11 years old, and I don't believe that makes me an alcoholic, but it just kind of confirmed what I already knew. You know, I wasn't good enough. I was different. If the girls that I was hanging out with knew the things that I had done, and the things that I had done with men, that they would think I was disgusting and not worthy, you know. And I didn't talk about being molested until I was in my second treatment center and 18 years old. I just felt like it was my fault and that nobody would understand, you know, very classic things that people with abuse talk about. So I took my first drink at 11 years old, and it was absolutely life-changing, you know. It did for me what Alcoholics Anonymous now does for me. It was a spiritual experience. You know, all of a sudden, I was okay with who I was. Everything seemed just a little bit more bearable. Like, maybe, I think I can do this thing called life. I'm going to be able to show up. And things that I said, I wasn't the funniest girl. I wasn't the prettiest girl, but I was okay to be there, you know. And after that first drink, I walked with a group of girlfriends. We went to this trailer park and had a man named Wolfman buy us alcohol, and he didn't make me do any sexual favors, which was really nice of him. And, you know, I got away with it. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do, you know, and I got alcohol anytime that I could. And I was really horrible at drinking, you know, horrible. Could not hold my alcohol, and got in trouble almost immediately, you know, just started getting kicked out of school, would bring alcohol and other substances to school. And I was in four different middle schools. I started going to juvenile detention centers, which I thought made me insanely cool. And I would tell you all about it, how bad I was and how I knew all about this other lifestyle, you know. And I would go, I would vacillate between like being really goth and angry and wanting to like kill myself and kill my family. Like that was goth then. It wasn't this emo thing that kids are doing now. But it, and between like being like really into hip hop and a gangster, you know, and I'm from an area of Miami, it's kind of like South Tampa, you know, like yeah, it was just really hard, you know, and like those streets are hard in Palmetto Bay, you know, and you would have thought so though, talking to me, and it was just you know, it was ridiculous, and. So these, I finally, I'm just going in and out of schools. I get put in an outpatient treatment center. I meet a bunch of other kids there that were like-minded and taught me how to get better at drinking, you know, and how to hide it better from my parents. And at some point, I do believe that my parents kind of just, they were done fighting me, you know. I was sneaking out. They're also, my parents are definitely parents of an alcoholic, you know. I remember stealing my mom's minivan and going, and I was like probably three blocks from the house at the first major intersection that I got to on 144th, and making a left turn, just get plowed into, call my mom. She comes to the scene and makes sure, you know, that she says that she was driving so that I can get my license in 2 weeks when I turn 16. And, you know, I had already been, so I'm having just problems, you know, problems living and I think that God hates me. I remember saying that a lot. My parents would be like, why? Like the fourth time they picked me up from juvie, my dad was just like, why do you do this stuff? And I was recounting, like, I was like, there was this girl there, and she was telling me that she comes from a family that is really just in, she lives in poverty, you know, and her mom's not home. Her mom got pregnant and has, like, four other children by different fathers, and she was asking me about my situation, and then I was like, no, you know, I live in Palmetto Bay, and my parents have been married for 25 years or whatever they had been married at the time, and she was looking at me like, what are you doing here? You know, and that was like a moment for me where I realized, like, this is not how my parents raised me to be or all of their hopes and aspirations and how they wanted me to act. And I have a sister who was raised exactly like I was, you know, and she is so normal and just adjusted. And same life that I had, you know. We're 17 months apart, not very different of stories, except in the amount of trouble that I seem to always find myself in. And so I go to several different high schools, get kicked out of a high school for cheating. Then I get, it's just problem after problem. And my second and third arrests as an adult, which I'm going back through this right now because I'm trying to apply for the board of nursing, and I have to like recount all of these arrests. They even want my juvenile record, which I think is really petty. But it's fine, and it's all going to work out, and it's okay. So I just having just creating a lot of bad situations for myself, and I got arrested 2 times in 3 days. Totaled my second and third vehicle in those 3 days, and got court ordered into a treatment center. And it was actually where I met our next speaker. And I arrived there and I couldn't focus on anything but the hot Spanish men that were in that treatment center. And there was a Spanish program at the time in the treatment center. And I fell madly in love with this man who's a boy. And I was kicked out and they said, you need to go to a place that has all women. And I said, perfect, I'll just have sex with women. Because I could not look at myself and look at any of those issues. I couldn't talk about being molested, any of those like deep-seated, the shame and the guilt that I felt over things that I had done, over the things that I had stolen from my family. I'm also a thief and a total liar. You know, I cheated my way completely through high school, pawned my mother's engagement ring, laptops, jewelry, anything I could get my grimy little sweaty hands on. And it, you know, the fact that, and I remember when I had 5 years, my parents still wouldn't let me in the house. Like, I wasn't allowed to have a key to the house. And I thought they were so messed up because I had made amends for what I'd done, you know? And I realize now, like, how much I really, peace of mind, like, everything that I really had stolen from them and how long it takes to rebuild that, you know? And so I, you know, I'm in this treatment center. I get sent to Jackson, Mississippi. And at the time, I thought Mississippi was in Louisiana, but it wasn't. It was actually a state. And so this is like what we're working with here. And I'm so glad there was no Facebook or anything from that period of time, because the way that I dressed was so raunchy and wrong. You know, like a Britney Spears. I don't know what I was going for, but it was just really bad. You know, and I'm glad I don't have to relive it on social media. So, I can't follow the rules there. Imagine that. And they're talking to me one day, or talking to my group, and they're like, you should not talk to this certain person because he is toxic to this therapeutic community. And I'm like, I wonder if he's seeing anybody because he should be my boyfriend. And I met him, and we moved in together within a week, and I just knew he was the one, you know, and that I was so in love with him, and we were going to be together forever. And just so you ladies know, and men, I felt like that like 10 times since then, and that feeling will always come back, and it's going to be okay, you know. For anybody going through a breakup, even my sobriety has been characterized by so many relationships that I'm just so glad. I'm just so glad that I don't feel like that anymore. That insanity of meeting somebody and being like, we're going to beat this together, this thing called life, with our daily drinking and craziness, you know. And I thought we were really passionate because we would scream when we spoke to one another. And it was just so real. It's so real. And So another thing that I do when I'm drinking is take money from men, and it's also been something I've struggled with sober, quite frankly, honestly, because I feel entitled and I feel like I deserve certain things in a lifestyle, and I'm sober, so shouldn't I have all of these things just taken care of? And that's not really how life works. So I moved the guy that's financially supporting me into my apartment with me and my boyfriend. So we were a high-functioning group of people. And he ended up committing suicide in my apartment, and I found him. He had shot himself in the head. And that was a turning point for me in seeing that things were really, really real. You know, the things that I was doing, the people that I was involved in, the situations that I was putting myself in, and I was just continuously going lower and lower. My drinking in Miami was a little bit like quasi-glamorous. I'd be in the club. I thought that's what I was supposed to do as a teenager in Miami. There was nothing glamorous about my drinking in Jackson, Mississippi. Nothing. You know, the places that I found myself in the things like, I'll never do that for this. I was doing all of it, you know, and my self-esteem, I'm just getting lower and lower, and I was degraded. And I started to really buy into this is who I am, you know, these are the things that I do, and this is who I am to get what I need. And that voice, like, just got constant, like, you're no better than this. This is going to be your life. This is who you are. And it had such a hold on me. And I'm trying to get sober during this time, which is even more horrible because I know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd gone to my first meeting when I was 13 years old at this group called the Coral Room in Miami, Florida. And I'd gone, and people had told me I was so cute and that why was I here? They, you know, I was so young and whatever. And so but I knew that I had what they had. When I would hear people share in meetings, it was so raw and real, and it like spoke to me. You know, I related. You know, I had that identification. These people were probably 18, 19 years old, but they were armed with facts about who and what they were and about their disease, and their whole deportment cried out that they had a solution, you know. And so I would go, you know, I would go drunk, but I would go. And so I'm trying to get sober, and but it's different now, you know. I like just couldn't stop by saying I wanted to stop. I would go home and I would drink, and where had been my high resolve, and I would make all of these, like, I'm going on the wagon for keeps, you know, a lot of promises, frothy emotional appeal promises, but I never made a decision. You know, I never got on my knees and said, God, please help me. Please make this stop. And so I knew what was going to fix it. I was going to get into school, and then I would have to stay sober. And right before I was supposed to get into school, my boyfriend stole our rental car because I had wrecked my car right before. And that's another thing that I do. If I want a drink, I need to just full speed smash into a brick wall. Because that's what's going to happen. It might even happen tonight, driving home. Oh, thank God Chris is driving. I am a horrible driver, you know, and I'm like 3 years out from totaling a car, but it still could happen at any moment. You know, I'm really trying to be better, but yesterday I had a really close call. So just almost right into the back of somebody. I just don't pay attention, and it's, I shouldn't be driving. So as this is all happening, I can't, I know that I need to quit drinking, and I just can't simply go to my first day of class because my boyfriend is missing, you know, but really I just wanted to get drunk, you know, and have people feel sorry for me, and where's your car, and this is so horrible. And so I make it to school on the fourth day, which is really a miracle. It was a Thursday. And I go to this American government class, and the teacher's talking. I should know kind of what's going on. I am from the United States, but I mean from Miami, Florida, but I am from the United States, and I just don't know anything that he's saying. And this girl raises her hand, and she says, Dr. Grummel, what's your favorite kind of wine? And he says, I don't drink. I'm allergic to alcohol. And I know what that means. At least I think I know what that means at that time. And so I go up to him, and I'm like, I'm going to need help. I graduated high school like 2 years ago, so I've been out for a little bit. And how allergic to alcohol are you? And he took out a 14-year medallion, and he put it on the table, and he said, this is how allergic to alcohol I am. And I thought he was so old. He was like 34. I'm 31 now, and he was like ancient. And he was like, I got sober at 19 years old, and I was in a car accident. My best friend was in the passenger side. He was killed instantly, and I just felt this identification with him, you know, because Larry had just killed himself 2 weeks before. And he said, do you want to go to a meeting of AA? And I went with him. I'd been to this meeting before. I'd picked up white chips at this meeting before. Probably people in that meeting, not like they were even thinking about me, but I was thinking they were thinking about me. When they saw me pick up a white chip, it's like, oh, there's that girl, you know, that picks up a lot of white chips. And I went home to a partner that was still drinking, you know, and I don't recommend doing that. And I haven't done anything right, especially in my first 5 years of sobriety, and I get really, like, moved by that because I think there's been a lot of God's grace in my life. You know, there's people here that, like, get very honest and that do the work, and they go back out. And sometimes I can't explain why some of us get to get it and why other ones get to stay. And I'm just so fortunate that I got to stay one more day, you know, that I got to stay for a little bit more time for this whole thing to sink in, you know. And the bottom line is, as I was two-stepping, I would go to meetings and I would do things like this. I would speak and I would say how amazing I was because I got sober so young. But I would never do anything that inconvenienced me for AA. I didn't have a home group. I had a sponsor by name. My fourth steps were like those 40-page, like, just like very, like, I just wanted to talk about myself and my how sick I was all the time, you know, and I wanted you to tell me, like, that my life had been so, that my abuse and things that I had done and that it was going to be okay, and I wanted you, a human, to fix me. You know, and I've tried that in every way for a human being to fix me. And guys, I promise, like, if a human could do it, I would not be here. Because I've tried every relationship, friendships. You know, I'm like that psycho friend, like, be my best friend. Like, I'm not that kind of a friend today, but I've been that friend. And I'm just so, I'm so fortunate that I got to stay here. And, you know, I'm a serial monogamist, so I was in yet another relationship that lasted 3 years. That's kind of my point. And when they didn't want to be with me anymore, I started to attack them and beat them, and they wanted to put a restraining order on me, and my parents wanted to Baker Act me, and I had 6 years, you know. And so I come home to Miami. And I didn't want to go to meetings, you know, because what I said to myself was, look, they're really superficial in Miami. People are going to bring that out in me. It's something I really struggle with. And my sponsor in Mississippi, Paula, said, sounds like you'll fit right in. And so I went to a meeting, you know, and there was this new group starting in Miami Young People's. They elected me to a position that first meeting. And I really got involved for the first time in my entire sobriety. I got in the middle. And the message that I heard from my sponsor was just all-inclusive. And I really started to feel those things that I would hear, like people with 4, 3, 2 years that I would look at baffled because they had this peace in their life. And here I am with 6, 7 years, and I'm like, I hate my life, I want to die. How do they have this thing and I don't? I'm so much way more sober than them. And I started to get it, you know. I started to have a peace, especially in the midst of calamity. And I still have had, you know, I had a bad relationship in there. I really started putting God first in my life and seeking a connection, because I didn't have that conscious contact. I wasn't talking to God throughout the day. It was more like foxhole sort of things, like, God, please get me out of this. Like, show me what to do when I'm in intense emotional pain already. You know, I don't have like a friendship where I'm constantly talking to God. And I started to grow that, and people that were not supposed to be in my life kind of left without a lot of drama, or not as much drama as they once had in my past. And the people that were supposed to be there just like flooded in. And I started to feel like I had a real purpose. You know, I'm a child of God with a message, and I'm uniquely qualified to help women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes that's all I know about myself, but I know it. And it's like so real and so true and such an amazing feeling to feel like so a part of, because that's all I ever wanted. That's all I ever wanted with my drinking, was just to feel included. And a man wants to marry me.
that's like huge.
And my sponsor, before I met him, would tell me, like, if you want something better, you have to show up as better. And you have to show up as the person that you want. And if that's true, then I'm anything like the person that I attracted. So kind and compassionate and forgiving. I mean, I just can't even believe that, you know. Then I really believe that God is real, you know, because he's changed my heart. Because girls like me don't get to get married, don't get to be part of people's weddings, to hold their grandmother's hand and to brush their hair before they pass away. You know, these are the moments that make up my life today that, like, you might think are so unimportant, but they're so, you know, I'm just so, so glad that I didn't miss it all. And thank you guys so much for having me.
Just hit the red button when you're done. My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Nikki, thanks for asking me to speak. Tampa Bay YPG, thanks for letting me come speak. It's always an honor to be invited to speak. It's an honor to be invited anywhere. At the end of my drinking, I pretty much wasn't welcome anywhere, and that's including my parents' house. You know, when Rachel said that at five, and Rachel, thank you for speaking. When Rachel said that at 5 years, she still wasn't allowed to have a key to her parents' house. I know what that feels like. You know, when I would walk into my parents' house, my parents would scramble. My mom would run and grab her purse, and my dad would run and grab his wallet. And as long as I was in the house, they carried them wherever they went. Because if they left them unattended for more than 30 seconds, I was helping myself to what was in them. Not because I wanted to hurt them, but because I had a sense of entitlement. I had a sense of, I need. See, I didn't want, I needed. And that affected me way before alcohol. So before I forget to say it, my sobriety date is February 25th, 2002. God willing, if I can make it to the end of next month, I'll have 13 years. I'm a member of the Miami Young People's Group. And getting to see a group of young people get and stay sober is amazing. I was 23 years old when I got sober. I was young. I still think I'm young, but some people argue that. But as a little kid, as far back as I can remember, I felt different. I felt out of place. A lot of the things that Rachel was saying, a lot of the things that I hear most people say when they speak in a meeting. Some of the things that went on in my head were, some of you are probably too young, but I think that they're still on reruns, Saved by the Bell. I wanted to be Zach Morris. I didn't want to be like Zach Morris. I wanted to be Zach Morris because he was cool. He had a cell phone, he had Cavaricci's, and all the girls wanted to be with him. So I wanted to be him. He always had money, he always had fun. I wanted to be him. And there was a kid in my class in elementary school. Of course, right now I can't remember his name. But he was that kind of guy. Everyone wanted to be his friend. And I wanted to be him. Now, notice the word, I wanted to be him. I didn't want to be like him. Because even at a young age, I knew that if I was like someone else, that would be a costume and I'd still be me underneath, and that sucks. I did not want to be me. There was something wrong with me. That was before alcohol. 10 years old, I remember crying myself to sleep at night, asking myself the question, why was I born? Who's being punished by my existence? Me or my parents? Who did something so bad in a past life that I am their punishment? And, you know, that's not normal for a 10-year-old. I see a lot of people nodding as I'm saying it, so I guess it's normal for in here, but it's not normal for a 10-year-old. And that's before I started drinking. You know, I remember at 8 years old, my older brother, I have three brothers, two older, one younger. The older brothers handed me a Budweiser, it was warm. I took a sip of it, I spit it out, they started laughing. It was the most disgusting thing I had tasted. and I couldn't understand why they were so excited to be drinking it. What I did enjoy drinking was my mom's cocktails. Now, she's not a heavy drinker, she never was, but at like a party, weddings, bar mitzvahs, whatever, she would have like a screwdriver or a Sex on the Beach or basically a cup that was mostly juice with a little bit of alcohol. And I loved taking sips off of it. I kind of enjoyed that little warm sensation that went down my throat, but more than anything, I enjoyed doing something that I knew I wasn't supposed to do. That's why I loved it, because I knew I wasn't supposed to do it. I always wanted to do what older people were doing. I had two older brothers I looked up to. I wanted to do everything they did. When my parents would have friends over, I'd want to hang out with their friends, not go to my room. And all that is before I started drinking. But as the years went on, what started happening is these messages started playing in my head. And it was my own voice, so I had to believe it. And it would say things like, you're fat, you're stupid, you're ugly, nobody likes you, you don't belong here, nobody wants you here. Come up with real insane ideas of why they may have invited me out of necessity, not because I was actually a nice guy or anything. And that just grew and grew and grew. And when I was 17 years old, I was at a party, small house party, about 20 people. I knew everyone there, but I was miserable. I was sitting in the corner, miserable. I had convinced myself that the only reason I was invited to that party was to drive them, the people that I went with. To let you know the advanced distortion of my perception of life, not only did I not drive, not only did I not have a car, I didn't even have a driver's license yet. But I told myself the only reason they invited me was because they needed me, not because they wanted me. So I'm sitting there miserable, and a friend of mine comes up to me and says, Mike, it's a party. Relax, have a drink. And I had a drink, and that got a little quieter. So I had another drink, and it got a little quieter. And I had another drink, and it got a little quieter. Now, I didn't black out, I didn't get totally smashed, but I caught enough of a buzz that I was able to enjoy the rest of the night. And when I got home that night, I sat down on the edge of my bed, and when the room stopped spinning, I audibly said, I have finally figured out what's been missing. Why didn't I know about this before? And from that moment on, I made a conscious decision that I was going to drink whenever I could. Now, it wasn't daily at that point. I think it was a few weeks before I drank again, and then maybe a few weeks after that. Where my drinking kind of took off was when I was a senior in high school. I was 18 years old. I started working in a supermarket. And every night after work, they would sit outside drinking. Now, I was still in high school, so I didn't do that Sunday through Thursday, but Friday and Saturday night, I'd sit outside and I'd drink with them until 2, 3, 4, 7 in the morning, whatever was going on. They accepted me. They let me hang out. They let me drink with them. It just felt right. After I graduated high school, I made the conscious decision that I was going to drink every day because that's what college students do. College students drink every day. I made it, I think, 3 weeks into my first semester of college before I made another conscious decision that waking up in the morning to go to school was seriously affecting my ability to stay up at night drinking, so school was out. I always maintained a good relationship at my job because I knew I needed money to drink. So I have to do good at work so that I can guarantee and secure that I have money so that I could drink again, because I need to drink again. And I drank pretty much every day after that. A couple years later, after that job passed me over for a promotion, now, I was 21, I was coming to work reeking, not only of alcohol, because I had been drinking all night, but reeking because my cleanliness had kind of gone on vacation. And I would wear the same uniform. I worked in a deli. I would wear the same uniform for like 2 weeks. And I was also in charge of cleaning the kitchen. So, like, I'd get home at night, and my soaking wet uniform, I'd crumble it up, throw it on the floor. The next day, I'd kind of shake it off, put it back on, go back to work. I'd shower every once in a while. I think I did shower more often than I cleaned the uniform. But it's no surprise they didn't promote me. I thought they should have promoted me. So I left. I went in one day, told them, oops, I forgot my shirt at home. I'll be right back. I cashed my paycheck. I went back 6 months later to say hi. And that's how I do things. If I'm done, I'm done. I just walk away. And I thought that the reason my life was so crazy was because I had to work nights and weekends and holidays. So I got a job in a warehouse Monday through Friday, and I thought, this is perfect. Now I can live a normal life. And that first week, it went great. Went to work, went home, no problem. Friday evening, I decided I had such a great week, I'm going to go to happy hour, because that's what people do when they work a regular job. They go to happy hour. So I went to happy hour on Friday, and next thing I knew, it was Monday morning about 4 a.m., and I was thinking to myself, oh boy, I have to wake up for work in 2 hours. What am I going to do? And I was right back to where I was. And it took about a year, little over a year, before that job asked me not to come back. And they weren't very happy with the fact that I was borrowing stuff from their warehouse without their permission. But again, I had that sense of entitlement. See, anytime there was something that I thought had value, that I could take so that I could either go sell or trade to get the things that were of value for me, I did. I didn't care who it hurt. I wasn't thinking about someone getting hurt. To me, I was taking something off of a shelf. No one gets hurt by that. You know, I didn't rob strangers. Not because I'm better than that, just because I didn't get to it yet. I still had enough people close to me that I could rob from. I didn't have to rob from strangers. But when they asked me not to come back, my boss called my father and said, he's been stealing from us, and we think he's been smoking crack in the warehouse. And I was very insulted and offended by that. Not the stealing part, that I was just denying, but the smoking crack part, I was very insulted and offended by it. I tried smoking crack once, I didn't like it. How dare they call me a crackhead? Now granted, everything else I was doing was just like being a crackhead, but, you know, again, I was trying to figure out how I can save myself, how I can get back to drinking, because all I wanted to do was drink. The last 6 months of my drinking, not a day went by that I didn't think about, dream about, plan, plot, wish for an end. I didn't have the guts to try and kill myself, because I was convinced that no matter what I tried, I would mess it up, I would survive, I'd still have all the crap that I had before, but now I'd have new crap piled on top of it, and I didn't want that. So I didn't do it. I just wished for it. But when they called my family, my brother called me and said, you know, you're in trouble. I said, yeah, I know. He's like, we should meet up. We should talk. Now, the only part of his story I'll say is that meet up and talk was he wanted to make sure that I wasn't telling any of his information when I went to go talk with my parents later that night. If he ever makes it to these rooms, he can tell you the rest of that story. But the other reason he wanted to meet up with me was because he wanted to take my gun away from me. Now, that day as I was on my way to go meet him, I was close. I had my gun against my head. And I started thinking to myself, how can I make sure not to survive? Put it under my chin, put it in my mouth. How can I make sure not to survive? And while I was sitting behind the gas station in my car trying to figure this out, something just told me, go meet your brother. So I went and I met my brother, and we were sitting in a bar. He orders a drink. And again, something told me, drink's not going to help right now. So I didn't have a drink. I went home. I told my parents I needed help. Not because I wanted to stop drinking. I just didn't want to get in trouble. So I told them I needed help. They tried to figure out what to do. they sent me to rehab, I got scared and a little excited. Because all of my friends who had gone to rehab before me came out with much better connections than they went in. So I thought to myself, I'm going to get the heat off, and I'll come out with better connections, so I'll be the man now. I'll be the hookup for everyone. And luckily, I did not have that experience. I had a therapist who saw through my BS, no matter how much I tried, but she also let me stay in my BS until I was ready to come out of it. And she nudged me to go to AA, nudged me to go to the 10:30 p.m. meeting at the Coral Room, which is where the young people were at the time, and she nudged me to get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor and started going to meetings every day. I got out of treatment. I started going to meetings every day, sometimes multiple meetings a day, not because I thought I was an alcoholic, not because I wanted to stay sober, but because they let me come back. They didn't ask me for anything. So I kept going. My family didn't want me around. I didn't want to be around them. None of my friends were talking to me anymore, which is a blessing. But they welcomed me. So I kept going back. And at some point early on, I made a decision that I was going to do absolutely everything that was suggested, because I was convinced that everyone who spoke in AA was a liar. They weren't telling the truth. The people who got up and said they had been sober for multiple years, they were the biggest liars of all. There's no way that anyone can go a year, 5 years, 10 years without drinking. But I also knew that if I didn't do everything, smart-ass old-timer was going to tell me the reason it didn't work was because you didn't do the steps, or because you didn't have a sponsor, or because you didn't do service. So I did everything. And that first year I suffered. I suffered in silence. I didn't tell anyone. I put on a mask of happy, joyous, and free. Every time I had a chance to speak in a meeting, I would say how wonderful AA was, how great my life was, how amazing everything was, and then I'd walk out of there wanting to drink. Because I wasn't being honest with myself or anyone else. And when I had about a year and a half sober, I was walking up to my home group, and my sponsor was standing outside, and he said, "Hey, Mike, just thought you should know I've been drinking for the past 3 days." Now, if I had still been obsessed with drinking, what better excuse to go get drunk than my sponsor's drinking? Now, do keep in mind, I said excuse, not reason. Excuses are all false. But as they go, that's a pretty good one. But the first thing that happened when he told me that was I opened my mouth and I said, "I love you. You know where we are, and I hope you're back here soon." I gave him a hug and I walked into the meeting. When the meeting was over, I went through my phone and I called this guy who I had already been talking to. And I said to him, and I remember very clearly, I said to him, "You are going to be my temporary sponsor until I find someone better." I have tried to find someone better. I have not been able to. He has been my temporary sponsor for almost 12 years, or 11 and a half years, something like that. I've had other sponsors. They've never been as good as him. If you don't feel that your sponsor is the best sponsor for you, I'm sorry. Find a new one. If you don't feel that strongly about your sponsor, you're selling yourself short. Not that my sponsor's going to keep me sober, but my sponsor, as I'm walking through the dark, my sponsor's like the flashlight in my hand. He's not going to protect me. He's just going to help me see what's coming. It's not going to stop anything bad from happening. It's not going to fix anything. It's just going to help me see. See clearly. See with open eyes. And he immediately noticed that I didn't have a very good first step. So he suggested that I read, in the big book, read the chapter to wives. And I thought to myself, I'm not a woman. I'm not married. What does this have to do with me? He said, "Humor me, read it. See if you can find yourself." And I read it. And when I got to, in that chapter, there's four classifications. I read the first one, and then I called him and I said, I'm number one. That's me. And he laughed. He told me to read it again, and he hung up on me. I read it again, and I kind of started to recognize myself in husband number two. I called him. I told him I was husband number two. He laughed. He told me to read it again, and he hung up on me. I read it again. Now I started to see myself in husband number three. Now, though I can be dense, I can also learn. Before calling him that time, I read it again. And when I read it again, I started to notice myself in husband number four as well. And as soon as that happened, it was like a weight was lifted from my shoulders. The fight was over. I knew I am an alcoholic, and I don't have to drink anymore. I can stay sober, and I can have a happy life. And it's not to say that it's been all, a friend of mine used to say, all sunshine and rainbows. It hasn't. Some days suck. But you know what? Every day that I've gotten through and I've learned something new, it's gotten better. And it's helped me to get through the next thing. It's helped me to learn more, to enjoy more. My parents, not only do they trust me in the house, my mom will often send me to her purse to get her credit card and go out and buy something with her credit card. My dad will send me to his room to get his wallet and bring it back to him so that he can give me change if I need change. You know, those are really tiny things, but those really tiny things are the things that we notice most. Now, what's amazing is I haven't thought of killing myself. I've thought of drinking, sure, but I haven't been obsessed with it. I've just had the thought, and the thought goes away. I've had financial troubles, still have financial troubles, but I'm not terrified of them anymore. My sponsor pointed out to me that the 9-step promise doesn't say that your financial troubles will go away. It says that fear of financial insecurity will go away. Today I know that my financial troubles are of my own making, and when I make a change, they will go away. So I'm not afraid of them anymore. In the time that I've been sober, I have had two big impacts. Both of them were similar situations, but at different times with different people. And two times, basically, my entire support group went out within a short period of time. Once was in 2007. I was on the host committee for FICCIPA in Miami. And in the couple of months leading up to the conference, a whole bunch of people started going out from the committee. And then the day the conference started, a whole bunch of people went out. And within 2 weeks of the conference happening, there were only five of us left. And I thought to myself, what do I do now? All of my friends are gone. Everyone I go to meetings with, everyone I hang out with, they're all gone. What do I do now? And the thing that has always been the answer for me was get into service. Get into service, help someone else, and rely on God. Because people, although I need people, people can't save me. Only God can help me truly. Now, often God does that through people, so that's why I need people in my life. But I need God more than I need people. And I learned that again a few years later, when again, my entire support group went out. And it's funny, because both times that that happened, I was presented with a new service commitment within a few days of it happening. And even though I was terrified of it, I took that service commitment. And this guy who thought there's no way that anyone stays sober, and I would manipulate the things that people would say to my own advantage, like, you know, one day at a time. Well, that means that I can't think about tomorrow at all. I can't plan for a life at all. I can only live for today, so I can't take any long-term commitments or anything. You know, like, you want me to commit to that for a year? No, you're not living one day at a time. But I've learned that I can plan for the future, but still live in today. And I've taken on commitments, and it's amazing. I've had the opportunity to serve on the FICCIPA Advisory Council, where I have gotten the opportunity to meet lots of people all over the state through that. Had the opportunity to be on the ICIPA bid committee, and again, get to meet people all over the place. Have the opportunity now to be on the ICIPA host committee, where I have the opportunity to meet a whole lot of people. Every time that things have been tough or scary or anything, new service always pops up, and it gives me a chance to get out of myself and learn a little bit more. Learn more about myself, learn more about AA, learn more about my fellow man. You know, when I had, I don't remember how long I had, but a few years ago, I was at a quarterly, an area assembly, which there happens to be one this weekend in Sarasota, which isn't far from here, so if you have time this weekend, come on by. I was at a quarterly because there was going to be a motion presented to allow YPA, Young People in AA, to have a table to be able to outreach their events. And when that motion went to the floor, they argued for like 3 hours. And there were people that were saying some very nasty things about Young People in AA. Now, I'm happy that I was naive and didn't know that every member of AA has the right to go up to the microphone and speak. I thought that since I wasn't a voting member of that body, I could not speak, and I just had to sit there and take everything that was said. So what I did was, when I went home that weekend, I made a decision that I was going to get involved in general service. And I went to my home group, and I became an alternate GSR, and then I became the GSR, and then at district I became an ACM, and then now I'm currently a DCM. It has given me such an amazing opportunity to see how AA works beyond the home group. In my first year, I don't think I could have handled it. Some people do. I don't think I could have. In my second year, I don't think I could have handled it. But having the opportunity to see AA grow, thrive, and flourish, not just in my home group, which has grown from 6 guys to averaging about 125 people every Saturday night, in just a few, I think maybe 5 years, in such a short time. But getting to see it also around the state, the new groups starting. Now there's 4 young people's groups in Miami. You know, getting to see the joy of living spread through the people around me is probably one of the greatest gifts that I get. Thanks for letting me share.